You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up...
General Flynn has served his country admirably. He is a three-star general. He's head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I look forward to having more discussions about this in the future.
Donald Trump's top policy advisor stops short of defending Michael Flynn as the president's Russian dilemma takes another chaotic turn. Plus, do TV debates help or hinder the political process? We'll also look at Germany's new president. And a little later...
I wanted to ask about the travel ban on Muslims.
Yeah, it's not a ban.
I'm sorry?
It's not a ban. The travel ban is not a ban, which makes it not a ban.
But you just called it a ban.
Because I'm using your words. You said ban.
Melissa McCarthy and Alec Baldwin strike satirical gold. But why is Saturday Night Live really getting under Trump's skin? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Elizabeth Broad, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Tom Rivers, ABC News London Radio correspondent. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Now, if you were watching the Sunday shows at the weekend, you might have caught Donald Trump's top policy adviser, Stephen Miller. He was out in force defending the president's immigration ban and knocking down suggestions of chaos and cluelessness even in the Oval Office. But when it came to questions of confidence in National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, Miller was conspicuously quiet.
Does the president still have confidence in his National Security Advisor?
That's a question that I think you should ask the president, the question you should ask Reince, the Chief of Staff. I'm here today as a policy advisor, and my focus is on answering the policy questions that you have. General Flynn has served his country admirably. He is a three-star general. He's head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I look forward to having more discussions about this in the future.
So the White House did not give you anything to say other
they
than
did
that
not give me,
on,
they did not
General
give me
Flynn.
Anything to say.
You cannot say
Chuck,
the president still has confidence in his national security advisor.
It's not for me to tell you what's in the president's mind. That's a question for the president. Well, it's a question for our chief of staff. Asked and answered, Chuck.
Let me ask you this. If you were caught misleading the vice president of the United States, would that be considered a fireable offense in the Trump White House?
It's not for me to answer hypotheticals. It wouldn't be responsible. It's a sensitive matter.
Stephen Miller speaking to Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press. Tom, we were listening along to that. It's not exactly a ringing endorsement of Flynn, is it?
No, it isn't. And it's kind of a very vocal standing right on the line, isn't it? On the fence. Again, it harkens back, Tom, to the fact that, you know, potentially you cannot, as a private citizen, engage in foreign policy. There's laws against that, and that's basically what this is all about. And we'll see what shakes out in the coming days. Again, that was a real standing back kind of a situation, not backing Flynn, 1%. So it could be the first real personnel setback for the president.
And Elizabeth, we'll probably talk about this in a bit more detail now, but it is interesting if we look at that personnel front for Trump, because it's being run like a campaign still, which is what we predicted, or many predicted. Is it the first of many? Do you think it'll be infighting? People are watching each other. They're trying to jockey for position. There's a great deal of concern about saying the wrong thing, endorsing the wrong man. Should we gear up for this to be the way it's going to be in the White House?
Absolutely, I would say. And of course, the charm of the Trump campaign and his selection of people around him was that they were inexperienced politicians. They were people of outsiders. And it was going to be different, right? But it's one thing being a maverick and another thing being an incompetent politician. And I'm not saying that Flynn is an incompetent politician, but you run a risk when you appoint people who have very little experience running the government. Now, Flynn has, of course, served in the military and the Defense Intelligence Agency, but many of the others have not. Now, I think that's a recipe for missteps waiting to happen.
I wonder, though, Tom, what do you think people watching on, whether it's members of the public or particularly the media, are they looking for proof positive of inexperience and maybe even ineptitude? Or is there a risk in a way that the personnel issues begin to overwhelm even the considerations about the substance of what people are talking about? I mean, is that a risk that we run, do you think?
At this stage, I think ineptitude is going to come to the fore. If they see it, the population will get up in arms about that. But the personalities, every administration has a shakedown period. Now, this one is kind of even more strange than most. But there's a period of will they get along? What is the mix? Who's aligned with this side? Who's aligned with that side? That is natural, but it's taken to an nth degree in this particular time.
Elizabeth, it's interesting. Trump's made his reputation, certainly his TV reputation as a reality star or whatever you want to call him, with his love of hiring or firing, more specifically. Do you think he's already, I mean, this is purely speculative, but do you think he's already reimagining his coterie, I think you described it? Do you think he's already looking around him and saying, this is a bit of a liability, not quite sure about this for the long term? I mean, should we expect changes, I don't know, if not imminently, within the next few months, in terms of those close rank personnel?
Well, if he were a rational politician, I think that would absolutely be the case. But he also seems to be somebody who absolutely hangs on to the few trusted advisors who he has and who have been with him from the beginning. And Flynn is one of them. And I think in any other situation, he would be regarded very much as a liability, especially so early in the presidency. But now, since he was a loyal campaigner or supporter, advisor to the president during the campaign, he is being rewarded.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what do you think that Trump needs to do? And we'll talk about this a bit later, given his sensitivity, his thin skin when it comes to satire in the program. Mm-hmm. But about this idea that, you know, the media is not—it's not rounded on itself, but it's putting a great deal of pressure on the likes of, say, Spicer, other sort of advisors of Trump. Do you think that Trump himself can retake control, or does he risk becoming embroiled in spats, embroiled in sort of, you know, mudslinging?
I think with his approach of tweeting and doing that a lot and continuing to do that, he's adding fuel to the fire. And if he in some way, shape or form can say, you know, I'm going to step back from that a little bit and let these things burn out naturally, I think that might be the way to go. But if you keep being incensed by things like satire, it's not going to go away. And the press, the White House press corps, is acting very differently this time than it has for decades. And they are learning that they can be a little bit aggressive on their own. And it's a different situation. And it's confrontational. And he's setting the tone for that. And he can set the tone of throttling it back if he so desires.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned this idea about him tweeting. It was obviously, a lot of people speculated about whether he would continue to do that. He certainly hasn't lost his appetite. And it's proving to be a headache for people on the National Security Council and his advisors. The New York Times reported that effectively retrofitting policy objectives to fit with things that he's tweeted is causing a lot of problems for his staffers. Conversations between the president and others are kept private. Fears are mounting over this sort of insider threat program that could come with cell phone and email monitoring and so on. Elizabeth, what do you make of the fact that Trump is continuing? I mean, we shouldn't be surprised. We keep saying we shouldn't be surprised that he's continuing
to
honour his campaign behaviours, if you like. But this idea that the staffers are having to kind of try and keep up with him and retrospectively fit policy objectives to seemingly fairly arbitrary remarks that he's making. I mean, again, it's unprecedented like so much else, but that's a very particular policy problem, isn't it, for them?
Absolutely. And these being civil servants, they don't have any particular obligation to him. They obviously have an obligation to their jobs, and nobody would resign just on the spot. But I think, as we have already seen in the National Security Council, many civil servants are choosing to go back to their agencies that they originally work for. They are on secondment to the National Security Council, and so they are going back to their original agencies. So that's leaving the National Security Council short-staffed. Well, that's a very serious problem, because if you don't have the civil servants who will give you impartial advice, who's going to tell you the truth?
And Tom, this idea about, you know, not trusting the trust, formerly trusted lieutenants, or not trusting, I guess, those broader that bigger machine of mm-hmm. government. What kind of problem does that lead to? I mean, it's interesting that there are certain people in the camp talking about insider threat. Well, you know, do we need to start listening in to make sure people are kind of on message? I mean, that takes the White House in a very, very dark direction, doesn't it?
I don't know about dark, but it requires an extra amount of effort, because instead of just writing a report as cleanly and as intelligently as you feel, you're almost double thinking everything and making things to fit, as you say, Elizabeth, in some cases. And it really becomes a very, I would imagine, a very stressful and a draining experience. It's much simpler to say, this is my research, this is what I conclude, and you're done for the day, as opposed to trying to fit it in to, if you will, the political angle that was tweeted out 2 hours ago. And it's difficult to live in that kind of a world.
Elizabeth, on this point about, you know, the role of whether it's military leadership or the intelligence leadership, which we keep coming back to, and there's a bit of skepticism, I guess, from Trump and his advisors about those people and those institutions. I remember talking a lot during the pre-Brexit campaign about, oh, we've had enough of experts telling us the ways, you know, a lot of politicians came out with this sort of language. I mean, this is a concern, isn't it, that even with each passing day of the Trump administration, that skepticism about advice seems to be growing. And he seems to be, as you already said, more determined to listen just to this smaller clique of advisors. I mean, again, that is very concerning, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I lived in Washington during the 8 years of George W. Bush. And he at least had the humility to say, I'm not the most educated person, most well-educated person, not the best informed person, but I will appoint advisors whom I will listen to. Now, you can say his advisors weren't the best either, but at least they were experienced. And with Trump, he doesn't even seem to have the humility or maturity to say, well, actually, there are lots of things in the business of governing that I have no idea about. Lots of things in the big world outside Manhattan that I don't know anything about. And that's a very scary thing.
Tom, I just wonder, what do you think is most likely to continue to trip up Trump and perhaps trip him up more seriously? Is it going to be the fact that he makes a terribly misjudged decision? Or is it more likely that actually it will be his failure to respond, to cite the kind of experts in the way that Elizabeth says there? And actually, it'll be a more simple, smaller scale problems that will wrong foot him. It will be simple incompetence. And actually, even a lot of his core support, they won't like it if he's seen to be making, you know, procedural errors even.
I guess the example before us is the travel ban right now. And he's, you know, it was a program that was run through so quickly. The minutiae of questions that raises doesn't seem to have been worked out in the least. And just to make a blanket statement and run with it, meaning, yeah, but what about green cards? What about whatever? And not having thought that through trips you up, because he's got a host of other things that he would like to work on. But now he has to backtrack and go back and back. He's going to the Ninth District Court. He's going to the Supreme Court. He's going to write up yet another executive order. It trips him up. And if he leans more on people that are in the know, even saying, this is my direction, this is where I want to go, give me the 20 potential problems, that solves a lot of issues, as opposed to just going, let's make it happen, because those problems will raise to the fore, and we all see them black and white.
And if I can just jump in there, I think that Trump's, not only I think, Trump's power base really is the voters who put him there. And it doesn't really matter whether the so-called establishment thinks he's wrong or whether they criticize his policies. But once those voters who put him in the White House start getting tired of him and start saying, well, you know, these tweets were entertaining during the election campaign, but really, we're adults. We have better things to do than to rant about, Ivanka's dresses and so forth. There are bigger problems there in our world. Once that happens and his power base starts crumbling, that's when he will be in trouble.
And I just wanted to, on that exact point, do you think that the response to his missteps changes with time? I think there was that expectation and understanding that he was new, he was inexperienced, mm-hmm. but he came in as an outsider candidate. So perhaps the public, even his core support, would say, well, okay, he's not going to get all of these things right. He tried to push through the ban. He's just mm-hmm. doing his best. If we're sat here in, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months' time, that... He's just simply not going to have the same kind of scope, is he, in terms of the public response?
Totally agree, Tom. The penny will drop. But when will the penny drop? And I don't know. Was it 2 months? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? I don't know. But yeah, I think there will be a day of reckoning. But maybe we're not in a honeymoon period right now, but we are. We're going to be a referee and say, well, we'll let that one pass. Okay. But at some stage, we're going to start playing hardball and saying, no, you can't do that. And we're not there yet, though, Tom.
Not quite yet. Elizabeth, just before we move on, what do you think will be the driver of when we hit that point? Is that going to be about the media upping the pressure? Will Trump and his inner circle do it to themselves by infighting? Will it be from the public? Will it be, I don't know, public activity or protest? What do you think will be the driver that will hasten that moment that Tom describes there?
I think it's when working Americans realize they've been had. And that's already happening a bit if you look at the number of... Republican congressmen who are being essentially shouted down by their constituents.
Mm. And I suppose the polling suggests that he's uniquely unpopular, Trump, already in terms of a new president. So we shall see. Mm. Coming up next, our television debates, good for politics. Why Germany's new president is being hailed as an anti-Trump. Good moment for that, I suppose. And is Saturday Night Live really getting under Trump's skin? Stay tuned.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from London, on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards, still with me, Elizabeth Brohr and Tom Rivers. You might struggle to find much common ground between Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and far-right leader Geert Wilders, but both agreed to pull out of a TV debate planned for the weekend. They accused broadcaster RTL of breaking an agreement to host just four parties. And if the recent American election is any indication, the whole tradition of TV debates may one day soon be a thing of the past. But even if they're not necessarily compelling television, are they an important part of a democratic election? Elizabeth, maybe we'll come to you first of all. And whether we look at the Netherlands or just more broadly, Has the time come, do you think, for TV debates? Have they stopped being as potent a force as perhaps they were before?
I don't think so. But it's interesting to think about how they have developed. It's an American export to Europe, and they haven't been around for that long. But we are already seeing the limits. So who should be in the debate? In the US, mm-hmm. it used to be easy. Two guys, the Democrat and the Republican. But in the parliamentary system, who should be in the debate? Should the parties that are currently represented in parliament be in the debate? Or should be everybody who polls above 5% or whatever the threshold is? And it's extremely tricky. And of course, then another question is, should populist parties be allowed in the debates? Do you give them a forum, a public platform by allowing them in the debates? Or do you actually increase their popularity by excluding them, because then they can cast themselves as a victim?
And Tom, that's a really key point here, isn't it? And it's a narrative we hear, especially in Europe, where populist parties are making so much traction, is this idea that if you deny them the voice, it plays into their hands, whereas if you give them the platform, they tend to highlight their own inadequacies. But are we safe to trust that logic?
I think we are. I think we are. And again, it raises the point Elizabeth makes as well. If you are a candidate of one of the two leading parties and you end up with 10 people around a table, it really dilutes the quote-unquote event. It's hard to have a definitive knockout punch in that kind of a forum. It's difficult. Whereas it's just two people, it is like a boxing match, and there is the potential for having that. Oftentimes, there's not. It's pretty flat, and it's, you know, both sides reinforce their base, and the polls don't change that much, and sometimes the candidates are just happy to get on the backside of one, two, maybe three of these debates. They're over. Not much has changed in the carry-on campaigning. But there is the potential there for, I knew Jack Kennedy, and you are no Jack Kennedy. And when you have those moments, that can change the dynamics of a campaign.
So do you think, Elizabeth, if we look at the Dutch example then, you know, is that a mistake maybe of someone like Mark Rutte? You know, should he have tried to insist that this goes ahead because he wanted to, you know, take on Geert Wilders very directly and challenge him on his, I don't know, if you, their most offensive and egregious views? Or do you think ultimately in that example where, you know, there's such kind of hair trigger votes, maybe it's better for both to just leave it well alone?
Well, he definitely looks like a sore loser now, or somebody who's too afraid to debate. But on the other hand, these sort of walkouts by established politicians may actually be a good thing, because it calls focuses on tension on the fact that TV debates are flawed, and should we really have them? And if so, who should be in them? And actually, there was a recent example in Germany, in the state of Rheinland-Pfalz, where the prime minister, who is a social democrat, refused to participate in a TV debate by the government-run TV station because AfD, the protest party, was invited. And the TV channel said, well, we're a democracy. Mm-hmm. Everybody who polls above a certain figure gets invited. And but she walked out. And how can you have a debate without the key players present?
I just wanted to, maybe before we move on from this, do you think ultimately, though, it will be, you know, that old chestnut that the viewing figures will decide it? I mean, it was interesting when, I don't know, Hillary and Trump in those presidential debates, say what you like about how much they helped electors to make up their mind, but it certainly was a spectacle. And whilst it continues to be, that's going to be the key.
Oh, yeah. It's, everybody remembers the moments. There was a second debate for me, where Hillary was off yakking and Trump jumped in and said, yeah, but you'll be in jail. I mean, that was the second debate. That was it. It was 3-second soundbite. And that's really what these things boil down to. And again, historically, if you have three debates, the first is the most watched and listened to, and they tend to fall off. But it's difficult. You can't really, if you're in a two candidate debate, you really can't play games. You have to show up and you have to do it. You can't pull out of these things, because then you are in trouble.
No hiding places.
No,
and
exactly,
as you said, from that Trump and Clinton debates, we certainly learned all we needed to about Trump's approach. Let's move on, because there's a couple more things that I want to talk about briefly. And it was interesting, Elizabeth, you mentioned Germany a moment ago. I'd like to go there now. The daily newspaper, Berliner Morgenpost, is hailing the nation's new president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, as the nation's anti-Trump. He's criticised those who he says make politics with fear, and pointed to the Alternative for Deutschland, who you mentioned, and others who he referred to as preachers of hate, Trump amongst them. But of course, with little actual power at his disposal, Steinmeier is maybe preaching to the choir, while the right-wing wave is still lapping at Germany's shores. Elizabeth, what do you make of this? I mean, it's good, clearly, to have outspoken politicians, even if they are largely ceremonial. But is it worth his while to try and get involved in these very big issues of current politics?
Absolutely. And I think we could, it's safe to say that what Germany, the person Germany needs now as president, is an experienced politician. Mm. As you know, the former president was an East German pastor who made his name as a democracy activist, but he didn't have any political experience. And he was very good as president, a uniter, somebody who spoke in moral terms. But you don't really negotiate any sort of peace deals to the extent that it's even a possibility for a German president. But you don't engage in international affairs as a former pastor. So this is a very good move for Germany. And Steinmeier has this long and distinguished record, most recently as a foreign minister. And he was very good and is widely respected.
which is something of a surprise these days. It's interesting, though, Tom, isn't it? Steinmeier said he'll stand up to the sort of trend to populism. Mm-hmm. He also said he'll stand up to those people that think, in a world which is becoming more difficult, the solutions must become simpler. Can one man, even if he's in a largely ceremonial role, actually affect that kind of change? Can he really challenge those kinds of trends?
I don't know. In the same breath, do celebrities have any impact in American elections anymore? Probably not. But it's refreshing. As you say, Elizabeth, he was respected, very well liked. And you're putting out the counter argument. And I see nothing wrong with that. In a sense, Trump would probably applaud that. Saying, I can put this out, you can put out your counteroffer. And that's maybe a good and healthy thing. The impact will be in September. The proof will be in the pudding. Will it have any traction? I have no idea.
Elizabeth, how do you think Steinmeier is best served then? If he's trying to get this message out, spread it more widely, tackle these hate preachers, as he calls them, what's his best strategy? Is it to just try and make as much noise as possible, you know, be on the media, be present, be very aggressive with his rhetoric as well? Or does he maybe need to be cleverer than that? What would you advise him?
Well, just to be himself, because he has this strong reputation, and he's not a charismatic politician. He's just a very solid German social democrat who has risen from a humble background and has done very well. And so just like everybody likes Pope Francis because he's a uniter and seems to be a beacon of reason, I think a lot of people who wouldn't ordinarily be paying attention to presidential elections in Germany will look at this election and say, oh, actually, there is hope for Europe yet.
Exactly. Well, we like an optimistic note, so that's a good one to strike. Time is short. Finally tonight, a word from White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
I'd like to begin with the president's schedule. 3 p.m., President Trump is going to meet with the leader from Central Asia, President... Oh, boy. Alma Bek Atamad Yemedbey. Okay, to discuss the unrest in Kazakhstan. Specifically in... Oh, Jesus. So, write that. And they will be joined by his wife, I'm just going to pass on that one. You know what? Let's just call her Connie. Right? Okay, did that. Now I'm going to open it up for questions, and I'm going to probably freak if you start asking stupid ones. Speaking of freaks and stupid ones, Glenn Thrush, New York Times. Stupid hat, go!
As you probably guessed, that wasn't Sean Spicer. It was Melissa McCarthy making a much-anticipated return to Saturday Night Live at the weekend. Trump and his team are far from the first White House administration to be mocked by SNL or by other comedians. But as Trump's ongoing feud with Rosie O'Donnell shows, he's the first president to be so publicly bothered by it all. And Tom, I guess that's my question to you. Why does he make public the fact that it riles him so much? Because all that's going to do is guarantee they'll keep coming back for more.
Exactly. It's two dogs chewing on the same bone. So you just have to embrace it and smile and say, that's what satire is all about. And, you know, you're going to have less impact. Because if you and I start fighting over that glass of water here, we're going to have a mess when we're done. But if you just let go of it, We'll be moving on to other subjects, and maybe that's what he should do.
Elizabeth, any chance of that, though? Trump keeps showing he's so thin-skinned, the more that they probe and sort of, you know, sort of attack him using their satirical skills, which, as we've heard from Lesser, are pretty good, the more he seems to respond. He just doesn't seem capable of leaving it alone.
Absolutely. And it's something we tell our children when they're in primary school. If somebody is bullying you, just don't pay attention to them. Walk away. And he just keeps coming. It seems like, you know, he wasn't taught this elementary lesson. But it's interesting because it points to what one might call a dictatorial mindset where nobody must offend you, nobody must contradict you. And it wasn't that long ago that President Erdogan of Turkey sued Germany for a satirical poem by a German satirist. And obviously it wasn't endorsed by the German government, and it wasn't even that widely watched. But
well, it was after Erdogan sued, therefore increasing
the story. Exactly.
So if you are listening, Mr. Trump, maybe just let it go. That's probably the advice from both Elizabeth Brough and from Tom Rivers, my guest today here on Midori House. My thanks to both of them. Thanks too to our producer, Ben Ryland, our research team of Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Antia Longo, and our studio manager, Kieran Banerjee. More from us at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in.